Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Neil Ward, and I'm grateful that you are taking time out of your day to learn more about design educators past to tenure. I truly appreciate it. On this episode of Tell It to Neil, we are chatting with David Gray, the founding chair of the graphic design department at Santa Fe University of Art and Design, where he taught for almost a decade. His most recent role was chair of visual communications at Endicott College in Beverly, Massachusetts. David is currently living in Pecos, New Mexico, designing, creating studio art, writing his teachings, and offering workshops on contemplative design. Let's listen in. Hi, David. Thank you for being on Tell It to Neil.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's nice to be here.
So let's get started. How did you get into graphic design?
I think there's a couple of ways you could look at that. Professionally, I started working at a marketing firm right out of college. I had studied psychology and photography. I was interested in perception and cognition. And I was just a little administrative assistant making copies and mailing packages. And one day they asked me to, quote unquote, design an 8.5 by 11 brochure, a one sheet for something they were doing. And they put me in front of a computer. This was the mid-90s, program called PageMaker, I think it was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if I'm getting that correct. And I sat for the day with the words, choosing typefaces, choosing sizes, making columns. I'd never been trained, but just doing this was super exciting. It kind of brought together so many things I loved, which was visual communication, using the computer to make something, recognizing the beauty of composition and legibility and all these design principles that I just kind of intuitively enjoyed. And after doing that for a few months, I decided that was really something I wanted to pursue. So I left there and worked a handful of entry-level design positions at a copy cop in Boston, Mass., which is like a Kinko's, sitting in the back making logos,
business cards.
And then I worked at a slightly higher end printing facility that did like large vinyl banners for companies. And so I got to do, banners or announcements and postcards, a step up from just the logo and business card world. And I did that for maybe a year or so. And then the internet and websites exploded. And if you understood how to make some things, people were welcoming you into their web design firms. So I hopped in and worked for about 2 years designing medical and financial websites in Boston before I realized I was never trained and it was time to actually go become educated, get a little bit of history, a little bit of theory for what it is I was actually doing. Yeah.
Interesting. So other guests on the podcast, they talk about how when they were 7 years old and they were just naturally drawn to design and they knew they wanted to be a designer. It's interesting to me to see how each guest actually got into design and at what point of their life that happened.
Well, there's a second story and a third story to this. And
Please let us know. Please.
Well, I too loved design from a very young age. That really was my fine art, whether it was magazine covers or trading cards or comic books or albums, which, then turned into cassettes and CDs. But I was surrounded by commercial design without knowing it was commercial design. And loving things like all of Peter Saville's graphic design work for New Order and Factory Records, or just really appreciating Tibor Kalman's design work for Benetton or for Colors magazine without even knowing this was graphic design or that there were amazing designers out there that created visual languages that I was actually following or listening to. So I was really in love with all of that. I was DJing while I was pursuing this graphic design world. And part of why I'm a graphic designer is just because I'm not a DJ or I'm not a professional musician. I think I took all of my love for sound and music and put it into the visual world. So that was a big part of it. I think I always wanted to make something that was like design for as long as I can remember. I take that back. Before I wanted to be a designer, I wanted to illustrate comic books like every 8 or 10 year old boy, I think, at some point or another.
yeah.
But then it turned into design. Yeah, for sure.
So that's the second story, or is that the third story?
What's that? Maybe the second story. I think I really got into graphic design when I went off and got educated. But we could talk about that a little bit more later, maybe.
Well, actually, that's a good segue into the next question, is where or how did you choose your educational path? Was it something that you kind of knew of a certain university you wanted to go to, or was it more of a wherever I can get accepted, or how did that play out for you?
Sure. I was living in Boston. I was raised in Massachusetts, and I was in my mid-20s and hadn't lived anywhere else. And I was dating a woman at the time who was going to art school. And it got me really excited about what it would mean to me to go and be educated in the arts. I didn't think I could be a quote-unquote art kid when I was in college. It intimidated me. Like, the kids who really made art, I just was overwhelmed by. I thought it was amazing. I didn't know how to enter that stream, even though my heart wanted to. But at this point in my life, I decided, yeah, that was really something that I think I was ready for and I could take advantage of. So I just decided that I would apply to what I thought were the top 5 programs in the country at the time, not really knowing much about design education at all, or even kind of the subtleties of difference or the big differences between schools. So I just jumped in and decided I'd apply to Yale and Cranbrook, Chicago, was Institute of Art, Art Institute, I always mix up those words, and CalArts, and the Royal College over in London, and just thought if I got into one of these schools, I would go, and if I didn't, well, I didn't feel the need to go and just get a degree. I really wanted to go to a place that had the best of the best in my mind, and when I got accepted, I was very surprised and very pleased that CalArts reached out and offered me an opportunity. Chicago offered me an opportunity. And I spoke to both of them. Chicago offered me an opportunity with a teaching assistant's role, and it sounded really interesting, and I went to visit. And CalArts offered me the same kind of thing, and I went to visit. At the same time, I was speaking with Yale and Cranbrook. And at some point in the middle of all these dialogues, I realized I wanted to go live in California. I wanted to be on the opposite side of the country. I wanted to go be in the forever summer weather. And the teachers at CalArts, as I started to do my research, were really the ones I wanted to engage with. They were the ones in the 1990s that, in my opinion, revolutionized and pushed postmodern graphic design in a way that the faculty at the other schools, even though they were really intriguing to me, as a collective at CalArts, they had a power that felt greater than any of the other programs. So, I just jumped right in with all these people that knew so much and I knew absolutely nothing, and moved out to California and went to school at CalArts and had probably the most profound educational experience I've ever had or could imagine having. I learned so much about myself and about design and about the creative process. I learned about all of these qualities of what makes a great teacher. I also learned lots of qualities that make a teacher that makes me uncomfortable. And I think that it's a real blessing to have this profound range of experiences, everything from loving a moment to deeply crying out of anxiety and fear because you're totally confused and don't even understand, say, the critique of your work. And that's really the third story is, when I was there, I really fell in love with design in a way where it went beyond profession at that point. It turned into a vocation. It turned into a lifestyle. It turned into a way of seeing, a way of being. That really took it to a new place and made me realize I was not just a professional graphic designer, but that's the way I live my life.
That is quite a transformation.
For sure.
And really what, I don't know, maybe what grad school is meant to do?
Yeah, I would think so.
Definitely. So at what point during your education, when was your aha moment that you knew you wanted to be an educator?
well, it was a little slow coming. I've always been interested in education. When I was a grad student, I was teaching part-time in the evenings, or maybe it was the afternoons, to local high school students in Santa Clarita, a digital arts network program, they called it, where we were teaching high school kids how to edit video, how to make graphic design work, how to use Adobe software. And I really enjoyed that. I taught at a high school summer program for California, for the state of California, at CalArts one summer as well. And when I was younger, I had opportunities to mentor and such, and I really enjoyed that, but I never really thought of it as a career path in any way, shape, or form. When I got out of grad school, I was art directing a skateboarding sneaker company. I very quickly found what was one of my dream gigs from early on in my childhood and worked there for 2 years. I loved the opportunity, but while I was there in the second year, I was offered the opportunity to teach a night course at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, Santa Monica. It was incredible. The wife of one of my professors who taught photography there had seen my thesis work in motion graphics. They were looking for a motion graphics professor to come in and teach one evening class to the design students. I met with them. It seemed like a good match. So I began teaching in the evenings there. And within weeks, I absolutely fell in love with teaching and teaching college students. It was such a surprise. Like, within 2 to 3 weeks, I was immediately in love with not just the opportunity to be able to share all the stuff that I just learned and help people get better at what they do, but I got to see it right in front of my eyes. So to be able to watch young designers make things, to be able to then talk about it, to see them actually hear what makes something different, and then to see them put that into action, and then by the end of the semester to see their work actually improve, and improve in leaps and bounds. I was just giddy. I would leave after 3 hours of class and drive home for an hour just revved in my car, so excited by the opportunity. And then the idea that I was even getting paid to do this just kind of blew my mind. It was really, I think, the first time where a profession didn't feel like a job to me. Like, it was just a joy. I couldn't believe I was being paid to do something that I was loving every moment of. So that semester ended. The faculty there saw the work that came out of the class, and they were really excited by it. And immediately, and I didn't realize how rare this was, they said, "We have a one-year visiting faculty position. Would you like it?" I didn't have to apply. I didn't have to go through a process. They just offered it to me right then and there. Now, having been a professor for 15 years, I know how incredibly rare that is. So I feel very fortunate that I was welcomed into full-time teaching that way. And yes. Within a week or two, just, you know, I thought about it for a few days, but within a week or two, I immediately knew it was what I wanted to do. And I resigned from my art director role at the skate company. And starting that fall, became a full-time professor at Loyola Marymount for a year. And being a full-time professor as a visiting professor for the first year of your, I think, your time as a teacher, for me, it was fantastic. I very intuitively connected with teaching, so I didn't need a lot of mentorship for how to teach, you know, how to pay attention to the learning process, how to cultivate a syllabus that evolved, that built upon itself. I loved coming up with projects. I loved seeing the subtle evolutions of one project to the next, to the next, to the next, growing them, transforming them. So for me, they just kind of let me be. And I had a full year of teaching with no other real academic responsibilities. So I just got to focus on the teaching, be deeply engaged with it, really watch it and kind of evolve with it as I saw the things that worked and didn't. It was really magical.
And those are amazing positions where you can just focus on teaching with no other service duties or research pressures.
Again, now 15 years deep, I realize that is an incredibly rare opportunity. You either get it at the very beginning of your career when you have no experience, or you get it towards the end when you're just this master and all they need you to do is just kind of show up and teach because you're so incredible. In between, you're doing a lot of other things, you know?
That's a good way of stating that. So you got into teaching at Loyola Marymount.
Yeah.
So how did you get to where you are today?
Oh, God. Step yes. by step, day after day, year by year. Well...
No, because I think I think you have a very interesting story as to how you got to where you are today, and there were a lot of decisions that you made, conscious decisions to kind of guide your path through academia, and I think hearing that path is quite valuable because I am pretty sure you are not the only person that has traveled down that path before. But yeah, please expand on that.
Well, I'll pick a couple of things to share, okay. A couple of pieces on this long brick road. After the year at Loyola Marymount, the position ended. It was the summertime. I wasn't too sure what I was going to do. I decided to leave Los Angeles after being there for a handful of years and move back east and drop myself in New York City. But within a month, I knew that that was not where I wanted to be. I thought I was going to run around New York and do freelance work. But having been out in Los Angeles, my appreciation of nature, I know it's Los Angeles, but my appreciation of nature being outside
yeah.
and living a slightly slower lifestyle than the East Coast, when I got back, it didn't really mesh so well in New York City. And when I was younger, I really, really wanted to be there. I wanted to be creative in that city. But I think I kind of missed my window. I share this because when I got to the city and realized I didn't want to be there, I realized at the same time that teaching was what I really wanted to do with my time. So I looked for some new positions and was hired for the following fall. As we know as professors, it's a strange, long process. In applying, we live in a world where you make decisions in seconds and you text people and people know about things in moments. But you know, you're teaching and you're applying in October or November. If you're a finalist, you may not even know if you get the gig until April or May sometimes. So throughout that year, I applied and I got an opportunity to teach in upstate New York in Albany, where we met, and moved up there and taught up there for 2 years. It was a wonderful opportunity. I was an assistant professor. I had a full course load. I had some administrative responsibilities. And those 2 years were a time when I felt for the first time like I was part of a bigger community. At Loyola Marymount, I just went in and taught and I left, so I was with the students. At this school, I was really a part of the faculty, so I got to learn a lot and engage a lot with all sorts of other aspects of academia. How the bigger business functions, how schools operate, how departments work together. And at the same time, while I was teaching, I was given a lot of freedom by my colleagues, Gene Dahlgren, again, someone you know.
Yes.
An amazing, amazing, wonderful, beautiful human being and educator and administrator. She really believed in what I was doing and gave me the opportunity to both teach professionally in terms of professional practice and exploratory in terms of doing projects with students that were more in alignment, say, with CalArts experimentation. And at that time, I began to realize that my interest in mindfulness and in contemplation and in meditation could really be integrated into the visual arts, into design, because I was doing that on my own for years without realizing that's what it was. So I began to offer projects that integrated mindfulness, a way of seeing deeper into what it was that you were making. Not just the concept, not just the form and function, but how did it feel internally? How did it resonate? How do colors and forms and messages have a deeper meaning? One that perhaps goes beyond concept to direct experience. And these were things that have been explored in design, in art, in spirituality, in psychology, in science, in cultures for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And it was interesting to me to see that it wasn't so deeply ingrained in contemporary design education. So I became very excited and I had a wonderful time. But at the same time, I really missed being out west. So I decided to look for a new role out west and was offered an opportunity in Portland, Oregon, which sounded amazing, until I was offered an opportunity in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And Santa Fe was just one of those magical places that transformed my life in ways where I really, truly could not have imagined before I got there.
Hmm.
That opportunity, yes.
So please. did those two opportunities in Santa Fe and in Portland,
yeah,
did those two opportunities happen simultaneously, or were they kind of a little, okay?
Yeah, both those opportunities came up as potential new roles for me. They were very different. Portland was a professor position in a very large program in the city. It had a great structure. It had wonderful classes. It was a very interesting department, at least to me, and I was excited about it. But Santa Fe was a bigger adventure. They had an art department that was looking for a brand new graphic design degree. And they were looking for someone to teach graphic design with more of an artistic bent. The program was very traditional in their art department at the time. And being in Santa Fe, which is a very traditional studio arts and photography community, I fit in perfectly. So the idea was I would go to Santa Fe with no students versus an entire program that was already functioning and have the opportunity to build an entire four-year curriculum from scratch, write all the class syllabi, structure the program exactly the way I wanted to. And the chair of the art department was a Zen Buddhist meditation practitioner. And Santa Fe is a very, very spiritual place that they were super excited by my secondary interests in design. So I jumped right in, and I moved down to Santa Fe.
Oh my gosh, the universe just aligned perfectly for that,
perfectly,
for you.
Perfectly, yep. It aligned perfectly for the opportunity, but then there were lots of ups and downs here. For the first 2 years that I got to the school to build the program, I had an amazing time, but the program announced, or the school announced, that it was millions in debt and was going to most likely have to close their doors. So again, similar to my opportunity as a visiting faculty member at Loyola Marymount, for the first 2 years I was in Santa Fe, everyone had so many other things to deal with as the school acted like and felt like it was closing that I had all this freedom. So I got to continue to do what I did, but on levels yes. that really pushed the envelope of design education. I brought a dear friend down from Naropa University up in Boulder, Colorado, to teach on the wisdom energies of color from a Buddhist and psychological perspective. So I had graphic design students wearing glasses that tinted the world red or yellow or blue or green or white and held yoga poses and meditated, and then took those glasses off and felt emotional energies arise in them that then were the basis for their creative process. And it helped students begin to appreciate that there was something far deeper in, say, color than just concept or context. There really was a vibration from that light wave that vibrated internally in ways that actually triggered emotional sensations. And those emotional sensations in each person are also not the same. They are varied greatly depending on your own constitution and the way your basic nature has arose in this world. So my graphic design students had these opportunities to explore things that were very perceptually based, but not within the traditional graphic design canon of education. Yeah, I had a great time. And then the school was about to close. It was bought by a for-profit educational company called Laureate in Baltimore. And we revamped. And along with four other professors, there were five of us that were kept on as chairs of five departments. My program now went from a degree to a department. And at that point, we revved up the school again. We were about to close. We started up. And for the next 5 years, we had a wild ride. We basically tried to start another school from scratch. And my department quickly gained speed and grew from about 3 students to 120 within about 4 years. Lots of international students were brought in. Yeah, we had a lot of connections internationally. A lot of Mexican students were brought in, which completely transformed my program in the most magical ways that I never would have imagined. whole group of students coming in being trained very, very commercially in Mexico. They come into my program and I tell them they can be artists and that they can expand what they're making. Visual communication is so much broader than just making something for branding, just making something for marketing. That visual communication has a history of thousands of years. And coming from Mexico, these students also, many of them, were much more connected to a deeper culture. Whereas in the United States, we have really unfortunately destroyed our Native American culture as a collective culture in this country. But in Mexico, the Mayans, the Aztecs, the history of their visual communication, at least to me, seemed a bit more present still. So they had a, what I would like to say, a deeper time relationship to the way we work with symbols and imagery. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time. Yeah. Yeah, I could talk about that program in lots of different ways. We had incredible, incredible adventures in class, outside of class. I took students on meditation retreats deep into the mountains, completely off the grid, for weekends of mindfulness and meditation and silent contemplative hikes. Ways of expanding the way we see the world, ways of expanding how we appreciate our five sense perceptions so that students can come back to the design studio with a much broader group of relationships. So when they make decisions visually, it's coming from a much bigger experience. I think sometimes we're a bit inbred with art and design education, where we focus really on our lineage, which is wonderful, but we see that as sometimes the truth or the end-all be-all. And I think not just taking in, say, a trendy topic, which is absolutely fine, but taking in something that might be interesting in science or math at the moment and trying to work with that in design, I think it's really important just to help people see better, actually understand how complex relationships really are, the interdependent nature of everything. Really important.
Agreed.
We can separate it out when we have target audiences and marketing strategies, but as human beings who all share, well, most of us share, you know, a way of seeing, which is the use of two eyes, you know, seeing form and relationship, color and light, is a bit more expansive than will that convince someone or not convince someone to do something or buy something, you know?
Yeah, very true.
Yeah.
So during this time, so we're at about 7 years into Santa Fe, your time at Santa Fe. So during this time, were you starting to put together workshops outside of Santa Fe University, or is that something that kind of came out of your time there? Because, yeah, go ahead.
No, please. Yeah.
No, that was it.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. While I was teaching there, I was offered an opportunity to create a class for students of all majors. It was one of those classes, sometimes schools have freshman or sophomore level classes where they try to integrate students into, say, a writing course that has a particular topic. And these were called the sophomore roundtable courses. And I created a class called Artful Awareness. It was a dream class. It was a class that explored mindfulness as the basis for the creative process. And although I came from a design perspective, I had students in this class that were coming from all departments on campus: music, film, theater, photography, studio art, creative writing, and graphic design. And I created a course where we explored all these aspects of mindfulness and contemplation from philosophical, psychological, scientific, and spiritual perspectives. There were readings in texts from all those avenues. We had projects that I created where students could do them in any medium. So it was more about the exploration of that contemplation rather than the medium itself. So for example, exploring Charles and Ray Eames' film, The Power of Ten, I then asked students to make their own Power of Five in any medium. So in film, they could have filmed from the outside of a building inside, or they could have made it abstract with a form going deeper into the color. One student a writing student wrote a short narrative and then took a paragraph from that narrative and turned that into a short narrative and then took a sentence from that and turned that into a short narrative and took a word from that and turned that into a short narrative. So they were opening up in ways that expanded the creative practice again, but didn't matter what medium they were in. The benefit of having all these students in the same class too is that students could see how this could unfold in different mediums that they might have never explored or perhaps wanted to but been intimidated by. And because of that, I ran that class many times, maybe 7 or 8 times. Because of that, I had really cultivated a way of talking about this process to any type of creative practitioner. While that was unfolding, our school, because it was purchased by a very large for-profit educational corporation, they were connected to many, many schools around the planet. And because we were specifically an art school, and many of these schools were more generalized liberal arts schools with studio arts, graphic design, photography degrees, we began to cultivate workshops to offer these other schools. These workshops were a week long. A faculty member from the school would go to this other school, this other institution, and spend a week there. Sometimes we would teach a series of workshops to the same students for 5 straight days. Sometimes it was a group of students in the morning and a different group in the afternoon. Sometimes it was a group just for one day, and then I hopped to another school in the city for the next day, and so on and so forth. And within a very, very short time, my proposed workshop of teaching graphic design as contemplative art, using design as a way to look in and out and see the duality of the two simultaneously for both the use of other and self, became very popular. And within a year, I had the amazing opportunity to fly around this planet and to teach these week-long workshops to students in Mexico City, Guadalajara, Monterrey, all around Mexico. Well, I should say all around a certain region of Mexico. I went down to Sao Paulo, Brazil. I spent 3 summers in Milan, in Italy, teaching. I ended up living for 2 months in Spain, teaching these workshops in Madrid. I taught these workshops in New Delhi. It's really fascinating. I had the opportunity in the United States to teach them as well, down in San Diego. So to really take them outside of my own institution and group of students. And it was interesting because these things that I'm talking about, it takes a little bit of time to settle into feeling the fruition of these teachings. This is not about come into a class and in an hour I've taught you how to make something differently so you go home and you make it different. It can be much subtler than that. It could be about seeing the relationship of color in a way where it might take a few months or a few years for you to begin to explore what that means in the choice of color in your design work. So at my school, I could gain the trust of my students over semesters or years. It was a very different experience jumping in for a week with students who are being taught very traditional professional commercial design and having to both share what I wanted to share in a way that excited them, got them engaged quickly, but also didn't freak them out. You know, they had to trust me within a few hours, otherwise what I'm teaching is useless. If you don't trust the person sharing these truths, it just becomes like any other quote-unquote self-help where you're like, yeah, okay, I guess, fine, bye.
I love it.
You know, where you're like, thanks for telling me that, now I'm gone. So yeah, it was a very interesting experience. Wonderful, wonderful little period of time. That went on for about a year or two.
So yeah. How, I'm curious now, well, not now, but I'm curious, how did that differ from group to group? So the group that you taught in Delhi, New Delhi?
Yep. Yeah, New Delhi.
And then the group that you taught in Madrid versus the groups that you taught in Mexico, how did the result of their work differ between those different cultures?
You would think it would have differed a lot. What's funny is that the answer is it barely differed. And it really, at first, surprised me, and then it was very, very straightforward. These programs were modeling themselves after American graphic design education. And at the time, we are in the blog era. We're right before Instagram, and students all around the planet were being taught similarly at these schools, and we're looking at the same types of graphic design work around the planet. And a very singular language started to appear, as I'm sure you're aware of, where it was much less about, when I was in school, wanting that great new Swiss design book or that new book from London or the new book from Japan, because culturally they were making a very different type of pop culture design work. At this point, things were starting to look very similar. I couldn't tell the difference between countries. That there was that quote-unquote international style that was starting to appear. If they were all using English or Spanish, then the only difference was that actual wording in the language. But the styles that were appearing were very uniform. There was a handful of different ways of approaching things, the post-grunge thing, the contemporary minimal thing, the hand-drawn thing. There were styles. What I found really interesting was that in these programs, it didn't seem like they were engaging their students very much with localized design culture. In New Delhi, for example, there was very little, it seemed, in their work that was based on, and I don't know much about Indian design work, but the history of their pattern making, say, culturally, their symbols. It was very westernized. Yeah. So I would go into these programs and kind of push in a way where I'd say, well, you know, you don't have to just look at it this way. We could look at the things that are surrounding you in your home based on the history of your own culture. Or you could look at the way you see certain color in your culture. Is there a lot of green? Is there a lot of red? Is there a lot of blue? Is that of benefit? Should you continue using that? Or should you do the opposite and use more red because there's so much blue? I mean, I'm just saying something very basic here as an example. Yeah. But that's what I would bring to them to try to help them actually return to maybe some of this more localized cultural design work. And when I say localized, I even mean just entire countries, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, money's powerful.
Yeah. it gets
you to focus on something very different very quickly if that's of interest. And, you know, all these students in these schools, too, were very much being taught design to work locally, but to really think about it in terms of international business as well. And the international languages, I think, are really closer than ever now in terms of visual choices and styles, you know.
You mentioned that you were at Santa Fe University for about a decade or so. So between year 7 and year 10, what was there? Did you continue doing what you were doing, or were there other things that came up?
I did. You know, I continued doing what I was doing. The school started to shift a little bit. We had a group of faculty that were amazing creative artists in all of their arenas and mediums. And for a handful of years, we were being very, very supported, both financially and just mentally and emotionally with what we were doing. But like many businesses, sometimes when the finances get a little tight, decisions start to be made for different reasons and in different ways. And around the time when some of the budget constraints started to hit, like they naturally do with many schools, we had an amazing vice president at the school. He was really the connection for us between the Santa Fe art faculty and the Baltimore administration that was supporting us both financially and structurally. This man was an artist, is an artist, and an administrator. He was a perfect, perfect connector.
Yeah.
But he also did such a great job believing in all of us, giving us the freedom and the support that we needed to really grow these programs in the rich ways that we were trying, that he was offered an opportunity to become the dean of the School of Art at Pratt, when he left our school to go to Pratt, as you can imagine, exactly, yeah. An incredible opportunity, things, in my opinion, began to change. For me and my program in particular began to change a lot because the administration at that point didn't fully understand the angle I was taking. And because they were coming much more from the world of I am a business person and I am looking at education as a business, and the models that they were looking at were both for-profit and non-profit academic models, but they were really very commercially driven design programs. So over the next few years, what I found was I just wasn't being supported in the same kind of ways. At that time as well, we had a lot of things change. Because we were a for-profit, tenure was removed from our programs. Our titles were taken away. Everyone was just called faculty rather than having the assistant, associate, and full-time professor titles. And sabbaticals were taken away. So at a certain point, I was the chair of a department with very little secondary resources like an administrative assistant. I had 3 digital labs, 120 students I was mentoring, a full course load, and many other responsibilities. And after about 11 or 12 years of full-time teaching, I began to understand the difference between physical exhaustion and conceptual exhaustion. You know, the conceptual is, I don't really want to do this, I'm tired, I can't handle this, I'm not in the mood. But I hit physical exhaustion, where I was falling asleep with my clothes on. I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. I had really burnt out, and I understood why faculty get sabbaticals oftentimes after 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 years. I needed a break. I had been giving and giving and giving for so long. I was burnt out. So I stepped away, and I took a year personal sabbatical, where I explored meditation and my creative practice on a daily basis in my studio and began to really explore what contemplative design means to me without any clients, what it means to work with design elements and principles in a way that allows the element and the principle to vibrate at its highest frequency, to do what it does for our direct experience in the most refined or expansive way that it could. Very similar to the explorations of perceptual artists like Mark Rothko or Robert Irwin or James Turrell. These people that were considered or are considered studio artists, but are exploring the studio arts through what I thought was perceptual expression and the mind of a designer, seeing the relationships. So I took time to do that and began to explore that. And right as I was about to head back to the school, I decided to step away. The school was becoming a place where things were changing rapidly. Within a year, the school then actually, unfortunately, shut down for good.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was a really unfortunate time. The economy, things were happening outside the academic arena that were affecting the school. Things were happening inside the academic arena. I really thought this was going to be kind of where I'd be for the rest of my life, building this amazing program. In my mind, in my delusional mind, I saw, you know, the Bauhaus to Black Mountain to CalArts to Santa Fe. I mean, I was like, this is a direct lineage. I am going to build the next best graphic design program on this planet. This is where I am going to be until I die. But like with everything, with impermanence, things change. And yes, the school shut down, and I found myself humorously as a teacher with no school for a little while.
Yeah. So when you were at Santa Fe, you had mentioned that they took away tenure. Now, did you go through that process at Santa Fe?
No, I've never been part of that process in all these years. While I was in Albany for the 2 years, I believe tenure was there, but because I was brand new for the first 2 years, I was not involved with that process, and then I left. Right. when I got to Santa Fe, it was originally the College of Santa Fe, which technically was the oldest chartered college in the state of New Mexico, and they had tenure. But it was causing a lot of difficulties because they had faculty who had been there for 30 years as studio art professors, for example, who were tenured. And tenure is a funny thing. Tenure, I think, makes sense if you are, say, a science professor and your research is about something that maybe the school doesn't 100% support or understand or believe in. Having tenure allows you to pursue that without the fear of, say, being fired. Sometimes in the arts, I've seen that it also can allow faculty to become very lazy. Or maybe lazy is not the right word. Become very content with what they know and not feel the need to have to evolve with the times. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. So some schools removed tenure because they felt like it had become something that did the opposite, where originally it gave freedom. Now it actually inhibited departments from evolving and doing more because faculty could just say, no, I don't want to, or continue to do what they're doing without any repercussions. I think there were questions about that at the College of Santa Fe, but the moment we became the Santa Fe University of Art and Design and were owned by a for-profit, it was pretty clear that those things were not in their best interest. And they began to run the school like a traditional business, where we were not even on annual contracts after the first year, but it was just a traditional business, you know, a traditional 2 weeks kind of, no one was being fired in the middle of the year, but they ran it like that. And I think the difficulty with that is it puts a lot of pressure on you as an employee. The idea that you could be fired at any time takes away all that strength of being tenured, which is being able to speak your mind in a meeting. But if you disagree in a meeting and you do that a couple of times, that really is a reason for them to start to go, well, maybe this isn't the right person for us. And we can fire them if, you know, the conditions are correct. And that gives them the flexibility that's not there with tenure. So it was removed. So after all these years, I've never gone through the process. Probably for the best. It just let me keep making things and exploring things like I like to without having, I don't know, to convince everybody of its value, you know?
Yes.
A lot of convincing in the tenure process.
Well, so then after, for your year after,
yeah.
So did you get back into academia after that point, or what happened?
Sure. I left the school. I was still living in Santa Fe, and I began teaching part-time north of Santa Fe in Taos at UNM, University of New Mexico, Taos campus. I was just teaching one or two classes a semester, and I did that for two or three semesters. It was a real joy. The people are lovely up there. It was much more continuing education. It's a community college. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very different group of students than I was used to. I really love going deep with students who are incredibly passionate and just can't stop thinking about this or just want to jump into the studio and make and make and make. And I really like kind of cultivating that energy. This program's very different. It was for people who are retired or high school students looking for college credit or people who were young adults wanting to take a class or two or explore the arts. Lots of wonderful reasons, but it was a different engagement with the students because of that. And I did that for a few semesters, and it was lovely, but I knew that teaching full-time was really where my heart and soul was at, the kind of bigger picture experience as a teacher. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, too, I discovered that it's, at many schools, impossible to survive with an adjunct salary. That some yes. schools may pay a salary that can help you pay some bills. This school paid a salary where after an entire semester of teaching two courses, I could pay 1.5 months rent. Or 2 months, I should say, rent.
No.
With some bills. So I had to make some new decisions. There was a reality check at that point. And during that time, I began to look for a new teaching position. And was very close with some wonderful opportunities with colleagues. for some places that I think were very exciting. And pursued that for about a year or two and found myself moving back to Massachusetts, just north of Boston, to take a role at a school called Endicott College, a position as chair of 2 degrees, graphic design and photography. And that was a really exciting opportunity. And that was last year for the full year. And okay. While being there, I realized I really missed the West, that my heart and soul were actually motivated more by the location of where I was living than perhaps my exact profession at the time. So after going back east for a year and continuing as a full-time professor, I decided again to step away and move back to New Mexico, where I am currently living.
And working.
And working. And breathing. Yep, all of it.
That is an amazing journey. So we're almost, at the hour point of our interview. So wonderful. I just want to leave a little bit of time. If you had any parting thoughts or upcoming projects that you would like to talk about.
Some parting thoughts. Yeah, you know, I think we are living in a time when so much is run by the economics of the thing, by how much money we're making or losing. I think we're at a place right now where too many decisions are being made for those reasons. And it makes sense because we all have bills and we all need to survive. We need a roof over our head. We need food on the table. We need clothing. We have lots of monthly bills like cell phones and insurance. But I would like to suggest to creative beings that you continue to work just as hard making what you make, even without a client or without money coming in for that process, because there's something really powerful about the creative process that transforms. It's not a conceptual transformation. I think a lot of the concept being put into art and design these days is humorously base level, that we get that information in many other ways now. We can be told those truths in a conversation, online, YouTube, many other ways. We don't need to mask it or metaphor it in art. But what we can do is directly engage in the creative process, the making of things, for no other reason than just to feel the process internally, to appreciate the way it feels to look at color while making something. So for example, if you are designing something for a client and you're working with lots of blues and you're not working with that many reds, then you're staring at those blues for the entire length of the project. That's just like the exploration I was mentioning earlier where students were wearing glasses with blue tint and feeling an emotional energy arise. If you are staring at color for a client, you are staring at color, period. So if you take an hour at night and you make something, say digitally on the computer, and you move that beautiful slider in Photoshop between colors, and you watch the tone of that form change from red to blue to yellow, or in various tones of blue, and you just look at it, you can feel, if you're calm enough, the energy move in your body. You can feel it arise when you get excited about a color, ground and soften when a color is comforting or soothing. You can feel how colors, when you move between them, make you hyper or excited or kind of irritated or uncomfortable. That's just the tip of the iceberg. By making things and paying attention, you feel the way the energy moves around inside you. And by understanding that more, that awareness is put into your creative decisions the next time you make something. And then by making things this way, I truly do believe the energy is in a certain aspect of harmony that allows for a much bigger manifestation to arise. And I'll just kind of leave it at that.
Well, thank you very much for that parting thought. I love how you describe that process.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Thank you very much for being on Tell It to Neil, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, Neil. I really appreciate it. Best to you, too.
This concludes Season 2, Episode 8 of Tell It to Neil. If any of the facts or information included in this episode are incorrect, please feel free to get in touch through our email, hello@tellittoneil.com. If you would like to get in touch with David, please contact him through his website at www.dgrey.com.